Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm very pleased to have with me for the show this week, former CIA officer, whistleblower, a columnist for reader-supported news, John Kiriakou, and also Joseph Hickman, who's a former U.S. Marine and senior research fellow for the Center for Policy and Research. He was stationed at Guantanamo Bay. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
And you're both here to talk about the new book that you have co-authored. It's called The Convenient Terrorist, Two Whistleblowers, Stories of Torture, Terror, Secret Wars, and CIA Lies. It also has a foreword by Jason Leopold, who's now with BuzzFeed. I've interviewed him before. We've had him on this show. And this is about Abu Zubaydah. And there's a lot that people maybe think they know about Abu Zubaydah. There's a lot of horrible details about torture that he endured. Much of the information that we've found out by the Senate report into torture. So I guess I'll begin with each of you. And maybe to start with, I know that you wrote... was it, Joseph, you wrote a lead-in to the story, like getting into the story itself. So maybe you want to help set up, well, like what you wanted to do with this book about Abu Zubaydah.
Well, I did write the lead-in for The Convenient Terrorist. And what happened was I was waiting for the Senate report to come out in December of, gosh, I guess it was... 2015 now. I was sitting there waiting for it to be published online, and when it came up, I was looking for Zubaydah's name. I was working for Zubaydah's habeas defense team at the time. I went to see what they had in a report about Abu Zubaydah. And when it finally was published, his name was in there. It was in there 1,000 times. And he was waterboarded 83 times. It was all the enhanced interrogation techniques he went through. And while I'm reading it, I just thought to myself, I have to get a hold of John, because everything that he brought to light years earlier is being published by the Senate now. And John captured Abu Zubaydah. I worked on the habeas team. I was down at Guantanamo when Zubaydah was there. And I knew that we could set the record straight on who Zubaydah was, because right now, up till then, he was the third highest person in Al-Qaeda. The government was saying all these things, and none of them were true. And I knew that John and I knew more about Zubaydah than anybody. And we needed to set the record straight on who he was, because he was not... He was not the third in Al-Qaeda, but he also wasn't a choir boy. He wasn't a good guy. So we decided to write this definitive book on the man.
Yeah, to be clear, as you go through the book, it's really about wanting to know the nuances of Abu Zubaydah and pointing to where you believe the government, like the CIA especially, was not interested in addressing the complexities of who Abu Zubaydah is as an operative or just as an individual. I'm curious, just so we can establish for the interview, you know, how your views of Zubaydah changed, to the extent that you can talk about, like, what you were under the impression before, and then, now, as you're the author of this book, what sort of transformation you've undergone.
Oh, yeah. You know, in the very beginning, and when I say beginning, I mean 2002, when the CIA told me that Abu Zubaydah was the number three in Al-Qaeda, I said, okay, Abu Zubaydah is the number three in Al-Qaeda, and my job was to capture him. But as soon as Ali Soufan from the FBI began to interrogate him pre-torture, it became apparent that the CIA was just simply wrong. And this public identification by the White House of Abu Zubaydah being being a senior Al-Qaeda leader and perhaps one of the masterminds of 9/11 was just a lie. And so, the more information that came to light about Abu Zubaydah, the more I realized just how dead wrong the CIA was about this guy. And at the same time, they were using the most horrific torture techniques against him to get him to talk about things that he just was not able to talk about because he didn't have the access or the information. And so I feel like I guess I didn't do a 180-degree turn. I probably did a 90 or 100-degree turn. I think Joe is exactly correct when he says that, that Abu Zubaydah was not the terrorist mastermind that we said he was, but at the same time, he was not the choir boy that his defense attorneys say he was. He was something in the middle. And then we were both kind of surprised to realize that nobody had written the definitive book about him. And so we sat down to do that.
And there's also these larger issues, which, you know, we can really spend a lot of time focusing on Abu Zubaydah's background, and that's important to the book. But there are these few things that you wade into, which are murky. Part of your book, you do spend time differentiating between these concepts of offensive jihad versus defensive jihad, which is a difference that someone like Abu Zubaydah brought to his work, and you point out how for the longest time, well, actually, you know, it's still the same, that in our government there is no recognition of when people would claim to be fighting wars because they feel they are resisting occupiers. So why did you decide to include that in your book is something I just wanted to spend a little bit of time on.
Well, you know, in Arabic, the word jihad means struggle. It comes from the verb jahada, which means to carry out a struggle. You can have a jihad against illiteracy. You can have a jihad against poverty. It doesn't mean holy war. And so you can absolutely have a defensive jihad. That was what happened in Afghanistan from 1979 until about 1989 or 1990 as jihadis fought Russian occupation. Offensive jihad is entirely different. That's what we saw from Al-Qaeda, from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed planning the 9/11 attacks. That's what we're seeing from ISIS right now. But you're right, there is a real difference between the two, and we tried to make that clear.
And what I would add to what you were saying, John, is that there's this rich history, as you outline in your book, of both CIA and Saudi support under the permission and with the encouragement of the CIA to be backing these groups. And I think what's such a good contribution to conversation about the individual of Abu Zubaydah, but also maybe some of these other people who ended up being captured by us, to describe them all abstractly, is that they did have some nexus to fights, struggles that were backed by the United States in the past. So I leave that for you, Joe, if you wanted to say anything.
Well, yeah, I think that they had a lot of people that were captured. For one thing, a lot of people were captured on bounty, and with Afghanistan being so tribal, tribal members from enemy tribes were turning in other tribal members from other enemy tribes. It was a big chaotic mess in the beginning of the invasion because of that happening. And also, you know, there was a lot of these guys were left over from the old Afghan-Soviet war, where we were definitely directly financially and with finance and weapons supporting different Mujahideen groups and Mujahideen fighters, along with Saudi Arabia. And that was definitely happening as well.
And one thing you choose to do with the book, either of you could talk about this, is to highlight this other individual who you point out has been not subjected at all to any efforts by the government to bring him to justice, to prosecute him. You highlight Abdul Rasul Sayaf, who was, you know, very much involved in these Mujahideen efforts in Afghanistan, even pointing out later in the book that had a role with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And so why is it so crucial to bring him into the context of understanding Abu Zubaydah?
Well, Zubaydah did a lot of work for Abdul Rasul Sayaf and his group. He was very much connected to them, where he wasn't connected to Al Qaeda at all. He ran the Caliban training camp, which was, and I've had it confirmed by several other CIA sources that camp was a Sayaf camp, and he did set up camps for the Libyan Fighting Group. He was very close with Al-Qaeda. He was very close with Osama bin Laden. He was very close with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The 9/11 Commission report states that Sayaf was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's mentor. So he was the mentor of the mastermind behind 9/11. I really think, and I had other CIA sources say this, that in many ways, Sayaf is a much more significant figure than Osama bin Laden himself. He was more like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. So, and now Sayaf still has moved on. He's a high-ranking member of parliament in Afghanistan, and he helped write the Afghan constitution.
And I've also talked about people who are listening may remember that I've had some conversation about Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and how this person was very much involved in a lot of destruction. He was involved in car bombs and explosives and stuff of that nature. But again, he remains part of Afghanistan. Isn't he part of the government?
He's not part of the government, no. He actually went to school with Sayaf in the late 60s. They were, and they started a radical form of, a very radical form of the Muslim Brotherhood in Afghanistan in the 70s. They did that together. So there's even a connection with those two as well.
May I add something about Hekmatyar, too? You know, Hekmatyar has proven over the decades to be one of the most dangerous figures in Afghanistan. Yet, as recently as October or November of 2001, after the 9/11 attacks, CIA officers were still meeting with him, thinking that he was someone they could negotiate with. And he simply wasn't. You know, again, this was just really bad analysis and bad tradecraft on the part of the CIA.
And so I guess very briefly, maybe you want to do this, John, just recount what unfolded with the Able Danger program, which you highlight in there. It does seem to be a very critical part of the narrative of Abu Zubaydah.
I think I'll defer to Joe on that. He's really the expert.
Okay, great, Joe.
Well, Able Danger, I mean, it's hard to really talk about because terabytes of information was destroyed by the government. But there is, the important thing is they were on the right track of who, how Sayaf was really connected in this with what is left out there and how he was connected, made possible, he was possibly connected to 9/11. But it's important to put Able Danger in the book because it's another question. It was another thing that was answering questions, another program that was answering questions and then just shut down and destroyed. And I thought that was important to have that in the book.
In general, the sense that I get from reading the book, without necessarily zeroing in on a specific detail, is that there are assets out there, there are operations in which the CIA backed it. So if these individuals become subjects or targets for capture, if they're the people who were rounding up and actually bringing to justice, then it's going to jeopardize the narratives that they have for this history. It's going to change the way that the public perceives what they've been doing all along. And like, by and large, it seems like, you know, in a very general sense, that the CIA places a high priority on making sure that they can protect the way in which they've sold their previous programs or operations to the public.
Absolutely. I think it, at best, it would be just a huge embarrassment if this stuff, if all this stuff goes public. John, do you want to speak on that?
You know, this is such an important and complicated issue. And there's been so much disinformation over the years. Frankly, and I don't mean it to sound like I'm blowing the book's horn, but there was so much disinformation really since the capture of Abu Zubaydah that we wanted to set it straight. And even though these issues are very difficult and complicated, I think we were able to put it really in layman's terms so people can understand that Abu Zubaydah, while a bad guy, was wronged. You know, it's possible to have a scenario where there are no good guys. Abu Zubaydah is not a good guy, but the CIA and the Justice Department and the U.S. military are also not good guys. And I think we were able to convey that.
Yeah, I think I believe that, you know, like I said, there's some Zubaydah is a person, so his life is complicated. Everyone's life is complicated, and there's things in this book that is embarrassing to the government, and there's things in the book that are embarrassing to the defense attorneys and Zubaydah himself. It's just not. It's not a book I believe that the CIA or the defense attorneys want really to come out.
And so let's get to the part that a lot of people might be familiar, having followed the issues of CIA torture. It's well known, some of the horrific experiences he underwent while being interrogated. And so how do you place in all of this, how do you place what happens and what the role is of, you know, this team that is brought in from the CIA? What do you think is really happening when you've got, as is clear, the FBI having the ability to get Abu Zubaydah to talk, but then you bring in this team and they proceed and they're not able to do anything but wreck this person?
Well, this was a governmental pissing match of the highest order is really what it came down to. Just as background, you know, institutionally, the CIA and the FBI have hated each other since the creation of the CIA in 1947. It's been decades, or it had been decades of hatred and distrust. And so neither organization was able to work with the other. Abu Zubaydah was captured in March of 2002. He was sent to a secret prison just a couple of days after his capture. He was allowed 6 weeks to recover from his gunshot wounds. And then FBI agent Ali Soufan began interrogating him. Now, the FBI is a lot of things. It's a lot of bad things. But one thing is that it's really, really good at interrogations. The FBI has been doing these kinds of custodial interrogations since they interrogated Nazi war criminals at the end of the Second World War. What they do is they sit across the table from a prisoner. They establish a rapport. They establish something of a relationship. They treat the prisoner with respect, maybe offer him a cigarette or a banana or whatever, permission to write a letter to his parents. And over the course of time, and these things do take time, the prisoner will open up to the FBI agent. That is exactly what happened between Abu Zubaydah and Ali Soufan, where Ali Soufan was able to gather actionable intelligence that saved American lives. But because of this bureaucratic pissing match, the CIA didn't like the fact that the FBI had primacy in the case overseas. Now, normally, anything overseas means the CIA has primacy. Anything domestically, the FBI has primacy. But it was the FBI leading the case overseas. This infuriated the CIA's leadership. And finally, in late July of 2002, George Tenet, who was the director of the CIA at the time, went to President Bush and asked him to remove the FBI from the secret location and to allow the CIA to take over the interrogation. For whatever reason that's never been fully explained, President Bush did exactly that. And within hours of the FBI's departure from the secret location, the CIA began torturing Abu Zubaydah. He clammed up, and they were not able to gather any further intelligence from him.
So this is a critical part, and I want to spend a bit more time on this, because right now, and something that you've explored through your book, both of you, is the lack of justice or even just the impunity for torture, and the fact that all the officials involved in what you document, really, they don't even get the kind of low-level reprimands you might expect in their profession. You know, there's no consequence to them and in their job. There's also no consequence to them as far as criminal charges would be discussed. And so right now you've got a case going on with the ACLU with James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who are seen as the architects of a lot of these techniques that were used against the detainees. And they were specifically involved with Abu Zubaydah, and I know that you mentioned them in their book. If you just give me a minute, I wanted to just add a couple things that they're saying about Abu Zubaydah in these depositions that were published by the New York Times, or that they ended up obtaining. But it basically, Jessen was asked if he thought there were ever points in which detainees were actually unable to stop an interrogation because they could not provide the answer to the question that would end their interrogation. You know, he just didn't understand this question. There was an objection to this question. And also, he was asked about his role in the interrogations. He said, "We hadn't done interrogations of live terrorists before." I'm wondering if you think that's incredible that someone's being brought in who hasn't really had this experience. But then it got on and said, "Do you believe that there was any risk going forward into Abu Zubaydah's interrogation? No, if I would have believed that we would do that kind of harm to a person, I wouldn't have done it." He says, "I deliberated with great soulful torment about this," and added, "When I was called and asked to do this, I paused, I thought, I wondered, I take every precaution that I could. I asked every question that I could. I waited until the weight of the entire nation's judicial system weighed in on it and told us it was legal." And I think that's possibly where I want to really focus on, is the fact that there was this conventional wisdom, or maybe we could even call it hubris, that it was legal, very carefully crafted within this circle of people that were torturing people.
I have very closely held feelings about that issue. What happened to make it legal, and I use air quotes around the word legal, is that the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel stood on its head to, you know, make black into white and night into day to make it legal. The truth of the matter is that we have a federal torture act in this country passed into law in 1946 and signed by President Truman that specifically outlawed exactly the techniques that Mitchell and Jessen had used against Abu Zubaydah and subsequently against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others. Not only that, but we are both signatories and the primary drafters of the United Nations Conventions Against Torture, which also have the force of law here in the United States. Just like the 1946 Torture Act, they specifically ban the techniques that were used against Abu Zubaydah and others. In 1946, we executed Japanese soldiers who had waterboarded American prisoners of war. That was a death penalty offense, waterboarding. In 1968, in January 1968, the Washington Post ran a front-page photograph of an American soldier waterboarding a North Vietnamese prisoner. On the very same day that that photo was published, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara ordered an investigation. The soldier was arrested, he was charged with torture, he was convicted, and he was sentenced to 20 years in a military prison. Well, the law never changed. We changed. And the Bush White House was able to stack the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel with neoconservative ideologues who convinced themselves that it was okay to say that even though these techniques were banned by law, they really weren't banned by law. I would also take exception with Mitchell's comment that he deliberated soulfully.
It was Jessen.
Or Jessen, rather. What Jessen declines or neglects, I should say, what he neglects to say is that the CIA paid him $81 million to carry out this program. So there was another motivating factor in his decision-making process.
Oh, I thought that it was Jessen. I believe his statement was absolutely ridiculous. He's a psychologist. He knows what these type of torture techniques would do to a person regarding PTSD or anything else. He knew he was harming people when he's doing things like anal feeding or some of the worst ones that John could label off. I mean, they are just ridiculous. And for him to even say that as a psychologist is baffling.
Well, and then also just to clearly establish in our interview here, one of the excuses Jessen makes is that they're constantly being told, I don't know if this is coming from headquarters or it's some supervisor, someone saying, look, if you don't do this right, a nuclear bomb could go off in the United States. So we need you to get back to it and interrogate. And maybe that's just what people were told to say if they were called to take responsibility. But that doesn't change the legality of torture.
Certainly not. You know, I remember that nonsensical ticking time bomb scenario when I was still in the CIA's counterterrorism center. Some CIA officers really believed that there was another massive attack coming. Most did not. Most understood that really by the end of October of 2001, we had al-Qaeda on the run. And by 2002, there were fewer than 50 al-Qaeda fighters left in Afghanistan. So I always thought that this idea of a ticking time bomb was it was just a falsehood being perpetuated by the CIA's leadership in order to continue the program.
So, you know, another thing I just wanted to quickly mention before we wrap here is that James Mitchell was also making this claim throughout his deposition that Abu Zubaydah had threatened to kill him and others several times. And he said, in here, we're friends. Out there, I will kill you if I see you. That's what he claims Abu Zubaydah said to him. But I think that the context is missing, and then either of you can react to James Mitchell, because we talked about Jessen. You can say what you want about James Mitchell. But 47 days before he is subjected to all of this horrific treatment, he's in conditions of solitary confinement, which is already hugely psychologically debilitating to anybody.
That's right. You know, right after we captured him, I had a long conversation with him in which I said, I'm going to give you a piece of advice. I am the nicest guy that you are going to encounter in this experience. My colleagues in the CIA are not as nice as I am. If there's one thing I could urge you to do, it's that you have to cooperate. And he said, you seem like a nice man, but you're the enemy, and I'll never cooperate. And he was telling the truth. We're enemies. We're ideological enemies. So for him to threaten Mitchell and Jessen, well, of course he's going to threaten Mitchell and Jessen. They're torturing him. And besides that, he has seen us for all of his adult life as the enemy. So, you know, if their feelings were hurt, well, you know, maybe they should move past it. Otherwise, I wouldn't put any stock whatsoever in Abu Zubaydah threatening them in any way.
No, it actually, when I was in Guantanamo, there was, you received threats from detainees all the time. They would say, you know, you're really nice. Just like they said to John, you know, you're really nice, but you know, I would kill you if I ever was ever out of here and we ever met again. It's just, we're enemies. We're not, it didn't faze me a bit, and why it would faze these experienced psychologists is baffling.
Laughable.
So that's two questions, and I guess I'll put this to you, Joe, because you were stationed at Guantanamo. Do you want to highlight what happened to Zubaydah when he got to Guantanamo? He was in the black site. He was in the secret prison. He gets he's rendered to Guantanamo Bay, and then he's subjected to further torture.
Well, yeah, a lot of people think that the torture ended once he left the rendition sites from the CIA. But once he arrived at Guantanamo, within the first 24 hours, they gave him 1,750 milligrams of mefloquine, which is an anti-malarial drug, which Guantanamo does not have malaria on that island at all. But they gave him this drug five times the dosage it's prescribed. This drug is a hallucinogen. It's fat soluble. It stays in your system for months. And it raises havoc on your brain. A lot of people actually have taken it as a recreational drug instead of LSD. It's very, very similar to LSD in high dosages. And so they did, that was one of the first thing they did within 24 hours is give him, overdose him on this drug. And then they put him in solitary confinement for 21 days without speaking to anyone. He did not have access to anyone from the Red Cross. The only person that would check on him was his future interrogator would come in and see how he was. It was horrible for him the first month and a half, 2 months there. He was having some serious medical issues. I'm not allowed to go into detail on that, but there was a lot of problems, and the torture ended at the rendition site, but it actually began again as soon as he arrived in Guantanamo for quite a bit of time.
Well, neither of you, I know your backgrounds. I know this is an area you probably are maybe reluctant to touch, but I just want to add for context that the Physicians for Human Rights have done their own documenting of the medical professionals of what is public knowledge already in their role in this torture and drawn conclusions that make it look very likely that, you know, we could say human experimentation was going on in these facilities, that people were in some ways being treated as lab rats, and that they were even, in fact, maybe even being kept alive so that they could be interrogated, and, you know, in effect that would amount to torture. And so really you're keeping people alive just so that you can keep torturing them. And it's a very big concern that there were physicians or doctors that were involved in doing this sort of work. So I think the best way to conclude is to talk about what you want to happen, what you would both like to see people take away from this book, but also what do you want to happen with Abu Zubaydah? What is justice when we're talking about Abu Zubaydah? And then maybe I just throw in, you know, the issue that we have here in this country, which was just manifested very clearly through the outcome of a case that the Center for Constitutional Rights had brought against John Ashcroft, against Robert Mueller, and against James Ziegler, who is from the Immigration and Naturalization Service, where they challenged the rounding up of Arab and Muslim immigrants in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and they were trying to seek damages from these high-ranking officials, but the Supreme Court issued a ruling some days ago this month that basically said, well, during national security emergencies or wartime, you're not able to challenge the conduct of these officials. That's sort of a generalization, but that's essentially what they're saying here, is that these people may have had their rights violated, but they're not going to be able to bring a case. And so I add that for context. So, like, what would you like to see happen now with Abu Zubaydah?
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think two things. We wrote the book really to raise the level of debate on this issue. That was one of our motivating facts, and to set the record straight in the convenient terrorist about Abu Zubaydah. I think the fair thing to do with Zubaydah and any other detainee in Guantanamo is charge him with a crime and give him a trial. Personally, 15 years without being charged with a crime and for what he actually did, I think he should be set free. But we're a nation of laws. Charge him with a crime and give him a trial, and let's see what happens.
Yeah, I could not agree anymore. We are a nation of laws, and we profess to other countries to be a shining beacon of democracy and hope and respect for human rights and civil liberties. In fact, we're not. If we were, we would charge Abu Zubaydah with a crime and allow him his constitutional right to face his accusers in a court of law and to be judged by a jury of his peers. And we've not done that, nor, I believe, will we ever do that. If it were up to me, I agree with Joe. I would release Abu Zubaydah. He's been incarcerated under horrific conditions for 15 years, having never been charged with a crime. And so if we're not going to charge him, we ought to release him.
Yeah, and 15 years, that's longer than some murderers ever go to jail.
That's right.
So that's important. Mm-hmm. And also, so when you're on one last detail here, as you're both talking, would you want it in federal court? Because the military commissions system has been a miserable failure when it comes to bringing cases, even mm-hmm. just logistically. But also, it does deny justice for a lot of these detainees.
You're absolutely right. Yes. It's got to be done in federal court.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for giving me your time and talking with me. The book, again, for people who are interested, is called The Convenient Terrorist, Two Whistleblowers, Stories of Torture, Terror, Secret Wars, and CIA Lies. It's out now from Skyhorse Publishing, and it's available. They can get it through Amazon, right?
Yes.
Yes. Any,
at a discount.
Any bookstore.
Great.
Or any bookstore across the country. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you both for your work. I appreciate talking to you, and all the best.
Thanks for having us, Kevin.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hello, everyone, and that does it for our show this week. Hello, everyone. That does it for this show this week. Rania Kalik is unable to join us for this week's episode. She's away on reporting business. I do have a few short comments before we wrap. I do want to thank everyone who is a supporter and patron of the show. I really, really appreciate all of you. There are 135 people who are regular supporters of our show, and we're halfway through the year, and you deserve a lot of recognition for keeping our show going so far in 2017. I'd like to read a comment that was contributed by Kevin. He said, I just wanted to say I greatly appreciate Rania and Kevin as people and as journalists. I followed you both for years, even before the UD podcast, and I found you to be consistently on the right side of history. Your morality and ethics appear to be rooted in actual values and not in partisan politics or a personal benefit. When I've listened to your show over the years, I've been exposed to some other great people pushing for justice in the world and who have challenged me and broadened my thinking on a lot of issues. I also feel less isolated on the far left and feel like at least some people out there share my many frustrations with the quote-unquote left in the USA today. Keep up the great work and thanks for continuing despite the negativity you've experienced for speaking truth. Well, thank you very much, Kevin, for that very thoughtful and very generous comment. We definitely appreciate your support, and I know if Rania was here, she would say the same. I suppose there's just one quick thing that I would like to address, because it has to do with media and being part of the landscape, knowing that some of the reason why people like to listen to our show is because we give people a reprieve from the mediocrity, the propaganda, and all that is horrible about corporate media. And people find this show to be a welcome break. And in this week, the last few days of this past week, we saw a reality TV show president really, you know, come out in full bore, just in all its ugliness, with the boorish nature of this back and forth, this so-called, I guess you could call it a tiff, between Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough and the people of Morning Joe and MSNBC versus Donald Trump. It's just such a sideshow. And it was something that we were all expected to get really worked up with this past week. And it's going to come and go. And so rather than, you know, wait for Rania to come back, I just would like to make it clear to you that this is a complete sideshow, in my opinion, that there is so much more that we should be focused upon. I could barely work up any energy and interest. And I know that there may be people out there who say these are ugly comments that President Donald Trump is making. He's using his Twitter to say ugly, foul things. And there's these reports that that Joe and maybe Mika were blackmailed, but I really don't care. It's just complete and utter ridiculousness. This is the plot line for a political soap opera that you might watch on TV. I mean, a literal, like, ripped from a House of Cards kind of plot line that we might just sit back and enjoy while eating some popcorn. And meanwhile, this network is the same network that this past week hired Brett Stevens. Is a complete and utter war hawk, a dopish kind of a loaf, a person who is a climate denier, who was hired by the New York Times. You know, the New York Times holding itself out as this kind of like liberal bastion that's going to help save us and deaden the blows that Donald Trump levies against all of us in this next over these next 4 years. But meanwhile, you've got the New York Times and now MSNBC giving a platform to Brett Stevens. And, you know, Brett is someone who's willing to concern troll environmentalists who are really upset and afraid of what's going to happen these next few years with climate change. And a lot of attention is paid to his hiring, but we also should talk about the hiring of Megyn Kelly and also the fact that they brought on a fair amount of Democratic and Clinton hacks. And these are the people who they are allowing to be on the airwaves that are going to set the spectrum of debate. Democratic pollster Cornell Belcher, you have a former Hillary Clinton advisor Maya Harris, and a former Obama administration official named Wendy Sherman. Wendy Sherman was on the Democratic National Committee, or the DNC Platform Committee, and was part of that block of Clinton people that continuously obstructed efforts by the Sanders Democrats that were placed on that committee to advance progressive items. Particularly, Wendy is someone who's very pro natural gas fracking, and those efforts to have strong environmental planks in the DNC platform, things like keeping fossil fuel reserves in the ground, that was something that Wendy Sherman did not hesitate to try and obstruct and undermine while she was on this committee. And so, you know, now she brings her work, everything that she stands for, to MSNBC, all that is limited about her worldview as a establishment Democrat, and this is what people are going to see on MSNBC. The debate here, the spectrum for debate, is being narrowed. It's being controlled by the people who are at MSNBC. You can hire people who are from the right, like Megyn Kelly. You can have on guests that are so supposed to be like, you know, for these edgy interviews where you could challenge Alex Jones and really try to like hold him to account, or maybe like try to get to the bottom of what makes him popular. And meanwhile, what's missing from these hires are there really aren't any people that I can see that are affiliated with the Sanders phenomenon, that are affiliated with the rise of all of these grassroots organizations that are fueling a lot of the organizing, that are fueling the grassroots challenges to the Trump agenda. And it's very clear here what MSNBC is doing. And so for them to try to win over people like me and maybe people like you to be sympathetic to what Donald Trump is doing, when they need to focus. You need to focus up. Okay, your people are taking a hit. Joe Scarborough, Mika are being sorely disrespected. They're facing misogyny, you know, the worst kind of chauvinism, you know, whatever. It's unethical. It's improper. I mean, I don't personally think that we should bother wasting so much time on this, because the fact of the matter is that we have things like a climate agenda that is destructive, where you're rolling back rules, regulations that are supposed to stop pollution. You're opening up national parks to drilling. They brought in leaders from different indigenous groups or tribal groups in order to convince them, or I guess sort of use them as these props to suggest that they're on board, that their people are on board with letting extractive industries go in and destroy land in the same way that they're destroying land that is up in North Dakota, this tribal land that is sacred that they're using to where they well pretty much completed the Dakota Access Pipeline. And you have healthcare, this destructive healthcare agenda, which, by the way, is not the opposite of the Affordable Care Act. The opposite of what Trump is proposing is Medicare for All, a national Medicare for All system. It's truly what people support. You're finding polls where about 60% of the country actually favor this. And it's the direction that the Democrats need to be going. But you have California Democrats right now killing a bill, stopping a bill from proceeding forward in the legislature in California, and really going overtime to suppress efforts by National Nurses Union in order to get this thing passed, to start this kind of domino effect. I mean, we really have to be asking the question, which side are you on in this moment? Because the Democrats are, frankly, aligning themselves with corporate interests in the way in which they've decided to stall and not improve this bill. If there are defects, there really are and truly things with the bill that need to be fixed. But let's fix those. Let's keep the bill moving through the legislature. This is something that we could have wall-to-wall coverage of. You have the travel ban going into effect against Muslims, directly targeting seven particular countries. We have deportations rapidly escalating, a very, very horrible immigration agenda. These are sort of things that should be occupying our 24/7 news cycles. This is what I consider to be way more important than whatever the reality TV show president is doing or saying that might be mean or awful to some pundit that happens to be on cable news. I frankly do not care about the feelings of any cable news commentator or any cable news anchor. And I don't care if you're tired of getting yelled at or shouted or disrespected by the Trump administration. You know, do journalism and shut up. Go do something valuable. Go find something. Go You know, all these people going on and on about the Trump briefings, saying that they are upset that they're not getting this access, that they're not being able to film or videotape. You know what? The story probably isn't in that room with Sean Spicer, who's going through a midlife crisis that I'm sure he's going to write about in some book that'll make him a few million dollars someday. The fact of the matter is that Sarah Huckabee Sanders does not have the stories. She has the spin. She has the propaganda that they want you to publish, and it's really not what you're looking for. You know, you're being given a runaround, and I think that these media institutions should refocus and go back to their offices and start thinking like independent journalists, like alternative journalists, and try to really find the story. Go dig, you know, do the kind of hard journalism, do the grunt work that is necessary. Don't just sit there and try to get some quote from Donald Trump that is going to bring you mass ratings. And I'll conclude by saying that while I think he is a total heel and maybe one of the most vile people who has benefited from the rise of the internet, who has turned himself into a cause celeb on the right in the past 10 to 15 years, or credit where credit is due to James O'Keefe for sending someone as an undercover journalist to capture those statements from CNN to really show people that this is in fact a ploy by CNN, that they are totally concerned with ratings, that, you know, not only are they guilty of during the campaign season back in 2016 and 2015 building up Donald Trump so that he would be the candidate that ran against the Democrats, but also they're guilty now of pushing a false narrative about Russia and really amping up this idea that Trump administration and Russia are in fact colluding together, like Trump and Vladimir Putin are partners, and that there's something very nefarious going on. Well, the fact is that we've now got people who work within the CNN organization admitting that this is a farce, that this is a bunch of hokum and bullshit, and saying those words exactly. And it's unfortunate that it's coming from the right, because James O'Keefe is guilty himself of pushing fake news, of pushing false narratives. But let's also just admit that, in fact, let's also just admit that he's managed to uncover facts, important information that confirms the truth about what is going on at CNN, and it's tremendously helpful to us. So that does it for our show. And we hope that you will join us again next week for another edition of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast.